Thank you for listening to this Podcast One production.
Now available on Apple Podcasts,
Podcast One, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts.
Welcome to another round of Boardroom or Miro Board. Today we talk retrospectives with Agile coach Maria. Let's go. First question. You've spent 2 hours in a team retro, but the only input you've heard is Dave's. Boardroom or Miro Board?
Boardroom. In Miro, Dave can't hog the space because everyone can add thoughts anonymously, online at the same time.
Correct. Next. You need the team to act on feedback fast, so you turn all those retro notes into Jira tasks instantly.
Miro all the way. And I can assign those tasks to teammates.
You're nailing this. Now, you see hundreds of sticky notes from the retro. A real mess. But you organize them into 5 themes in just seconds.
Miro, I basically get back an entire hour when I use its AI tools for clustering.
And she's done it.
Join over 60 million people running actually enjoyable and actionable retros in Miro. Get your first 3 boards free at Miro.com. That's Miro.com.
The following program is a PodcastOne.com production.
From Hollywood, California,
by way of the Broken Skull Ranch,
this is the Steve Austin Show.
Give me a hell yeah.
Hell yeah.
Now, here's Steve Austin.
I'm sitting here with Bill Burr, one of the funniest guys I've ever seen on YouTube, and finally he's here in person at 316 Gimmick Street. The guy was kind enough to drive across Los Angeles in his Toyota Prius on a Saturday afternoon. Welcome to my house. Thank you for coming over.
Thank you for having me.
God.
You immediately broke my balls the second I pulled up. I knew I was going to get shit for that. Going over to Stone Cold's place, you know,
well,
a 9-year-old dented Prius. At least I got it washed before I came here.
People on my show have been listening to me knock the Toyota Prius for years. And just because it wasn't really so much the car, because the car is a very unique piece of mechanical engineering. It's badass, you know, the technology behind it. And here's the thing, I'm such a car freak. It's like the Crown Victoria, which is what, you know, you've been in New York City, you're from Boston, you know, basically all the cabs were, you know,
Crown Vics,
or all of the Lincoln Town cars, same thing. All those cars, 300,000 miles, 400,000 miles, they last forever.
Right.
And so when I get in these Toyota Priuses, the thing about it, when you get into a cab, those Crown Vics, the legroom in the back is for shit. All of a sudden, when these Toyota Priuses started coming into vogue and they started putting the taxi signs on them, you get into the back of those things, you've got twice as much room as it done a Crown Vic. So I started loving the Toyota Prius from that aspect.
Right.
And then the other day, I bought this Ford Focus that I showed you out there on my curb.
Right.
I'm going to make you a sweet deal before this podcast is over.
You just bought that?
I just bought that.
And you're already trying to get rid of it?
Well, it's because
you tried to sell it to me on the phone ride over here. And when I pulled up, you're like, hey, nice to see you. Bill, I want to show you this fucking pea soup green.
It's metallic pea, Bill.
Oh, sorry.
I'm going to make you a sweet deal on this car.
All right.
But I was on my way over to pick up my Ford Focus at the dealership because I bought it from my mother-in-law. I figured I was doing the right thing. She decided to sell it. We kind of settled at a price. It was low retail, high trade-in, so it was a fair deal for both of us. And then the repair bill came in, and the brakes were squeaking, all kinds of bullshit, and, you know, put it in the shop. And the repair bill cost more than I paid for, the son of a bitch.
Oh, yeah. That's so, why you don't buy off a relative.
But so, well, anyway,
you don't buy
I know, but
relative.
It was my
now
mother-in-law.
You're going to give her a dirty look during the holidays?
God damn it. I got taken to clean by my mother-in-law, Bill. I know the same. As soon as I drove off, she was just laughing her head and shaking her head at me. I got that big motherfucker. I got him.
Well.
But I was in the Prius going to the Ford dealership. I start talking to the cab driver. Dude, how's this thing on repairs? Never needs a repair. It had like 200-something thousand miles on it. Still going strong. So I respect the Toyota Prius.
No, it's a Toyota. If you change the oil every couple thousand miles, it's going to last. I mean, technically, every car should never die if it's made right. I mean, the engine block's made out of steel. All you got to do is just change all the fluids and not drive like an asshole. I mean, it should last forever, but people don't. They drive around with the fluids too low. They beat the shit out of it. You know, and then they think they need something new. I love it, dude. I'm telling you right now, that car, you know, I just got it washed so it's looking halfway decent. But when that thing needs to be washed, I could literally leave that car in the middle of a riot running and no one would take it. They might throw a rock through it or whatever, but I can come out. That's what I love about that car is I can take it anywhere. And it always runs and it gets great gas mileage. And I don't give a shit when people open their door into it. So I am finally getting a nice car, though. I ordered a car coming, but it's not getting here till October, and that's going to kill me when some asshole just opens their door into it.
But that's new car blues. When you get that new car, you know, it's like getting a new pair of tennis shoes. You're going to scuff those things sooner or later.
Yeah, except it costs you $50,000.
Yeah.
A little bit different.
Yeah. So when you bought the Prius, what was the inspiration behind that? I mean, because what were your other options?
My inspiration was that I was already doing enough damage. I put my own hole in the ozone layer, flying every other weekend or whatever. So I was just like, all right. And like the air quality out here is not great. And you can't really go that fast. I knew it was a Toyota. I don't know why I bought it. I think back then I was really into the whole, let me try to, you know, do something positive for the environment, which I still try to do. But there's just, until they deal with the population problem, you no matter what you do. I even think like these Teslas, what I want to hear is when they get rid of the battery, right, what does that do? What is that worse for the environment? Now, right, you know that's going to come out and the gas combustion engine guys are going to, you know, fund the study for that.
Right.
What about that dude who put it on autopilot and got himself killed?
No, I didn't hear about that.
Well, these kids were putting up videos. I saw one where they have the self-drive option on the thing, and they literally took a nap. They're going down the highway, and they wake up. They're like, oh, there's like an hour of the trip gone. And I was just like, I would never have the courage to do that. So some poor bastard was making those kinds of videos, and what happened was, whatever, he was asleep or not paying attention. I don't know what was going on, but the sun was shining. There was a giant, you know, 18-wheeler that was all white. It didn't read it properly. It read it as a daylight and just drove right underneath the thing or something. Now, granted, I'm telling you, like 20 people told me this. I've never looked at any video or read anything about it. So I'm just paraphrasing what they say, which is what I do. I'm not a big reader. Yeah, I don't even like watching videos. Like if whatever you tell me in the hour or whatever,
right,
I'm going to take as law.
Yeah, but see,
and I'm going to repeat.
But here's the thing, Bill. Whatever technology is, they've been talking about these cars that drive themselves. And dude, at 51, you're clipping in here at 48.
48. Just turned 48.
Just turned 48. So you knew
it. The odometer just flipped.
Just flipped. But man, I've been around long enough that, you know, I'm pretty skeptical. I dig technology, but I used to spend my life on the road. 15 years, I've driven all over the United States of America. We go to foreign countries, we get on buses because the driving laws are all fucked up over, and you're driving the wrong side of the road. And you don't know where the fuck you're going. But over here, Rick Rude, Ravishing Rick Rude. Are you a wrestling fan?
Big time.
So Ravishing Rick Rude, we should say, God damn it, Steve, arrive alive. So that's, we always try to get to the places safe and sound and perform in front of the people, put on a goddamn good show, and get on to the next rodeo. So I ain't going to trust no machine to guide me, because I was real picky about who I would let drive the car.
Right.
Like Mick Foley, love the guy to death. Don't let him drive. Diamond Dallas Page, one of my best friends. Don't let him drive. Fucking Jersey guy.
No, because they drive too aggressively, or there's two.
Not just Mick, and I love him. He's one of my best friends. But just,
having said that,
just you just don't trust him behind a wheel. I don't know if he is distracted. He's one of the smarter guys in the business. If I always wanted a good opinion, I'd go to Mick Foley.
Right.
Kevin Nash, good wheel man. Badass Billy Gunn, good wheel man. Okay, all of a sudden, you got the Tesla, you dial in, hey, here's your destination. I'm going to trust this GPS system, because when I moved to L.A., I remember I had the Garmin thing they used to put on my windshield, and Garmin would be telling me where to go. So they've advanced the whatever the GPS thing is to drive his car. I ain't trusting that motherfucker to get me where I'm going. I got to have the steering wheel in my hands, Bill. Maybe it's a control issue, but like it's like when you punch in the directions on your iPhone and Siri's telling me where to go and what to turn on. I can dig that. She's gonna get me there, but I got the steering wheel in my hand. So
I had to switch it to a guy's voice.
Oh, so you didn't like the girl telling you what to do?
Because I thought that was some subversive feminism shit for me to get used to taking orders from a woman. I didn't like it. Turn left. I used to find myself fighting it, like skipping streets and everything every once in a while, just be like, you know, just to keep it even. So now it's just like a guy's voice, and I don't have that. I got major like control issues too when it comes to that stuff, and I think technology was fine right up till 1995. Somewhere in the 90s, we had it right.
Right.
And then that's it. Okay. And you know, I know there's advances in medical and that type of stuff over the last, whatever, 20 years or so, but like it's not, in the long run, it's not helping everybody. You know, we're just living too long. People got to die. People got to get out of the magic number is of human beings that can be on the planet.
Yeah.
Like, I think we're over it by a good, I don't know, 4 or 5 billion.
Yeah.
It's got to be.
Well, you said you don't like to read. Or you don't read much.
I'm not good at it.
You're not good at it.
It takes me like an hour to read like five pages because every word reminds me. I have ADD, so I just start thinking about stuff, and I'll just go on some journey in my head as I continue like reading but not retaining anything, and then I'm like, what the fuck just happened? How am I on page 30? That's basically...
Yeah, because you don't remember the first 29. That's the same thing I do.
There's some shit that I like. I like to read. If it's like I'm good about autobiographies. Like you got all this, you know, the Stevie Ray Vaughan stuff. Like I any stuff on him, I would be totally focused, riveted, reading that. But if it was like, you know, back in the day, if I had like a book report and they just said read this fucking book, I'd just be like, I hated it. I absolutely hated it. So I was good at screwing around in class, and somehow I turned that into a living.
Hey, did you? God dang, you went to college, right?
I went to a bunch of colleges.
But you got a degree. You got a degree in what?
Communications.
What do they teach you in communication? Because obviously you're great at it. You're one of the funniest cats that goes around doing stand-up.
I don't remember. It was a fun, like, I finished at Emerson. I went to, like, two other ones, was accepted to another one, and I just, by the time I was, like, 22, 23, I was still a freshman. I was going part-time. I had to pay for it myself, you know, working my way through college and stuff, and I don't remember. I went to that school and I finally just, it was like a performance school and shit. I could do stuff on the radio. But I wanted to ask you, just as far as being a wrestling fan, I mean, you asked me when I was I a wrestling fan? I watched it hardcore from like 78 to right up early 90s, right when I started doing stand up. And then like I missed everything because when you guys were on, you know, the big stuff, I was out doing stand-up. So I missed like all of Seinfeld. Like I didn't see any of that until it went into reruns. I missed a bunch of sports in the 90s and all that. And I remember in the late 90s, the late great Patrice O'Neill.
Yeah.
And he's the great, him and Mitch Hedberg to me with the, and David Tell.
I'm glad you brought Mitch Hedberg.
When people always say like, man, you're like the funniest guy out there. It's like, yeah, because like the top five guys aren't here anymore. If they were back, you know, I'd be featuring at an improv. So, in the late 90s, I was living with another comic, Robert Kelly, and him and Patrice were really into wrestling, and that's when you and The Rock brought it back, and like all of what I've always admired about all you guys, because I never understood the amount of pain you were going through, was how goddamn funny all the characters were, and I mean, all the way from like, you know, Captain Lou Albano to Mr. Wonderful, you know, Rowdy Piper, all of these guys. I used to watch all of those guys and just laugh my ass off watching them. And then when you guys came along, you guys took it to a whole other level. And I always felt you guys were like prolific. Like each week when you thought you had all your guys' catchphrases down, you came up with new stuff. And we used to, me and Bobby would watch it and we'd have Patrice on speakerphone. He was living in New Jersey and me and Bobby were living in like this walk-through bedroom apartment. And we would sit in the living room on his pull-out bed. Obviously he'd, you know, fold the thing up during the day and we'd watch it on this little kitchen TV and just waiting to hear what you guys were going to say and all the different storylines and stuff. It was great, man.
You know, I had so much fun doing that shit, and finally I had to ride off into the sunset with injuries and stuff like that. And so although it is entertainment, it's a rough ride in there, or can be.
The best thing that happened was once they just said this is sports entertainment, then you guys could actually talk about the real pain that, you know, people just look at, because what they were thinking, oh, you know, it's worked out, it's fake or whatever. But it's like, dude, that guy still has to take a chair to the head at like whatever 3/4 speed. Do you want to do that or jump off a top rope and land or get slammed on your back? Like, I couldn't believe what I saw Hulk Hogan one time. So first time I saw him was in the airport, and then I saw him when he did the Opie and Anthony show. And I remember going like, man, I thought he was tall. I thought he was like 6'7". But like his arms hung way down to like his knees. And he said, I used to be 6'7". But after all those years of his finishing move, jumping up with the leg coming down, he lost 3 inches of height.
You know, here's the thing about Hogan. And I always give that guy a ton of respect because he had a tremendous run. You think something so simple as just jumping up and dropping that leg. Here's the great thing about that leg. First of all, it worked. It looked good. He was charismatic as hell, had a great look. But anybody could take that finish. So when you come up with a finish in pro wrestling, you want it to be something that everybody can take. So if it's a bunch of damn, you know, crazy toss around, whirly gigs, you know, and it's acrobatic,
right?
Hey, not everybody can take that, but anybody can lay there and get a leg dropped on them. But my point is, when you're 6'6", you're 320, when you drop that leg for 30 years, man, it's like interest. It compounds daily,
yeah.
Especially as you get up on in the years. So, you know, he's paying the price of that. Just a simple leg drop. And, you know, there was times, dude, my finish was a Stone Cold Stunner. So sometimes I'd go to TV on a Monday Night Raw. Monday Night Raw, Bill, was like therapy for me because it was like, okay, yeah, I get all my shit out.
It's we
like,
used to take that night off of stand-up. Yeah. Me, Bobby, and Priest, we would take the night off. We'd have him on speaker. I mean, one time I think he actually made the journey all the way in from Jersey just to watch it. And all three of us sitting on that little couch. We ordered, like, Chinese food. It was the greatest, man.
But sometimes you go to the building, like, hey, Steve, would give you about, you know, 6 or 8 stunners tonight. You know, bam, here's going to come down to the ring, give him a stunner, give this guy a stunner, give this, and I'm like, goddamn, my back's all fucked up. But you're not going to say, well, Vince, my back's kind of fucked up. I better take a night off.
Right.
You're out there ringing up stunners with a fucked up back. So it catches up to you.
It seems a lot like pro football, where their thing is always like, can you go is the question. And there's only one answer to that, or else you're out the door and someone else is going to take your job. So I don't know. I mean, one night me and Bobby, we were going to, thank God we didn't go through with it. There was this old comedy club, the Boston Comedy Club. And it people used to always joke. It looked like an old like ski lodge that sort of burned down. I mean, it was a shithole, had this wooden stage, small one too. And we were talking one night and he was going to do the Rock's finishing move. What was that? The Rock Bottom? That what it was called? Yeah. He was going to do that to me, or I was going to do it to him. And fortunately, I mean, I was already like 30 years old during that time. That would have fucked me up. He was somehow going to do it. And we were going to get into some phony argument on like a Tuesday night, like with eight people there. And he was going to pick me up and slam me down. We would try to work the whole thing out. And fortunately, we actually... Just because, you remember when you were a kid and you'd try to do all the wrestling moves to your friend the first time? First time, I remember doing the Polish hammer, and you didn't know not to interlock your fingers. You'd slam it to your little buddy's chest, and all your fingers felt like they broke off. And we didn't understand, like, all of those things. I fortunately had, like, you know, three younger brothers, so I could, you know, try out the airplane spin, everybody's move. But I remember the first time, one of the first two times I really fucked up my back. Fourth grade, this kid put me in a figure four leg lock because he was trying to show me how to do it, and he got me into it. And then all the kids started going nuts, and he kind of was like into the crowd cheering. He wasn't letting me out of it. So I got up to try to undo the leg, and I felt a pull on my lower back. That was fourth grade. And then the first time I messed up my upper back was Tony Atlas inspired. His finishing move was to put you up over the head. And I picked up my brother, who was about 4 years younger than me, and I went to pick him up over my head. I swear to God, it felt like my spine bent. And I got about halfway over my head. I still remember where I was at. I was in the living room. So fortunately, there was a rug, because when I had to drop him immediately. He was crying because he fucked up his shoulder. And, you know, so that's the funny thing. So everybody's sitting there going, yeah, wrestling's fake. It's like, really? When I do it, I still get hurt. So...
Well, it's funny because on your Twitter account, at Bill Burr, there's a picture of you and Nature Boy Ric Flair.
Arguably one of the funniest dudes who ever lived.
Oh, goddamn, he's hilarious, and he's my favorite pro wrestler of all time. But my point is, it plays back into your story about being in the figure four. Bill, next time you get put in the figure four, don't try to unlace your legs.
You
just
roll
over. You reverse the pressure.
Which way do I...
Either way, whether all you got to do is go belly down, and it puts the pressure on him. Allegedly, that's how it works. So just
do you know how cool it is, 40 years later, to hear it from Stone Cold Steve Austin? This is how you get out of the figure four. I'm going to teach my wife how to put me in it, see if it works.
You go, dude. Just go get on YouTube. Go push it. Put in, just push Flair versus Steamboat. And watch him put Steamboat in that figure four, and all of a sudden Ricky will get that crowd. And he's getting that crowd. Goddamn, he's almost got him. And finally turns it over, and the pressure goes to Ric Flair, and he goes to the ropes. So now he's selling the leg just like Steamboat's selling the leg. So there's no reason why, you know.
No,
kinesiologically or anatomically, why rolling over would reverse the pressure, but it's that just, was the story.
Yeah.
The Steve Austin Show. The Steve Austin Show.
Hey, man, you own or rent your home? Sure you do. And I bet it can be hard work. You know what's easy? Bundling policies with GEICO. Geico makes it easy to bundle your homeowner's or renter's insurance along with your auto policy. It's a good thing, too, because you already have so much to do around your home. Go to geico.com, get a quote, and see how much you could save. It's Geico easy. Visit geico.com today. That's geico.com. So tell me about starting off, dude, because you said you got three brothers, right?
I have four brothers.
Four brothers.
Yeah.
Okay, so, like, were you the funniest guy in the family? Were you always funny?
No, I was not. No, my older brother was still is ten times funnier than me. Everybody in, like, I grew up in the suburbs of Boston, yeah. And I just everybody was funny. I can't explain it. There's something basically about the New York, Boston, all the way down to, like, Jersey area, tri-state area and all in there. Everybody's like a character. But there's something about Boston where it's just like, I don't know, if you watch those reality shows, more times than not, at least the ones that my wife watches, those Survivors and stuff, there's always some Boston lunatic, you know, he's got the crazy accent. They're just a bunch of characters there. So I just think everybody, you know, was so funny growing up that you just sort of like absorb it. And there was all big families and stuff, and like fighting was accepted back then, and drinking and driving
I used to fight. Good old days, a fist fight.
Yeah, my parents. The rule was don't hit each other in the face. It was like hit each other from here to here. That was considered working it out amongst yourselves.
Yeah,
I remember my mother one time tried to smash a brush over my head because my brother said I kicked my other brother in the face, which was bullshit. I kicked him in the stomach. I don't know why to this day he said that. So my mother was brushing her hair. She had this big, like the 70s yeah. plastic, you know,
yeah, yeah.
Who's the fairest of them all brush. So she turned around and smashed me in the head. And I like did that pussy duck. Basically, you put your shoulders yeah. up and go, yeah. And she caught me right in the middle of the back. Right. And it would have been great for wrestling. The whole brush exploded. And my mother was like, you know, we had so many kids or just so cheap. I just remember she just picked up like the brush part. And for like the next 10 years, she was just holding the brush part. And every once in a while, I'd catch her using it. I'd just be like, you know, I would still be pleading my case going, I kicked him yeah. in his, it was his chest. I think that's why my brother had a bad angle. It was like a quick play at the plate or something. He yeah. had a bad angle. He thought I kicked him in the face. I didn't. To this day, I'll go to my grave denying that.
Dude, the thing, if you popped off to my mom and she happened to be in the kitchen, she had one of those wooden spoons in her hand and she got you cornered.
Oh, yeah.
She was going to wear your ass out with a wooden spoon. Yep. And she'd break them and my dad just go get her more wooden spoons. So
my grandmother broke
don't
one.
Don't talk shit to your mom when she got a wooden spoon. That was my deal. I learned that real fast.
My grandmother tried to break one over my head, but I got my arm up quick enough and it snapped. I kept messing up this rug, which she wasn't looking, a little throw rug. And she kept going like, who keeps messing this up? So it became like this game. And she went in the kitchen and she stopped real quick and looked back out. And she caught me messing it up. And she, dude, turned into the devil, just came flying at me like it was a hatchet.
Yeah.
And I just put my arm up. It was really weird because I only saw her a few times a year. So it was kind of like a stranger coming at me. And it snapped over my forearm. And then she just went, wow, that's the end of that spoon. And that was it. Went out and bought another one. My other grandfather used it to, you remember the 70s refrigerators we had the side by side? He couldn't handle the fact that we just kind of went in there and got something to eat whenever we wanted to. So he jammed the thing in there so we couldn't open it. So we were sitting there starving. Just an ornery guy. Just jerry-rigged this thing. We couldn't get anything to eat.
Okay, so we're going back to your stand-up deal because on, and researching, it says you started in 92.
Yep.
But you probably had to, you were testing shit out before then. What makes you decide to just turn pro and start in 92 on the stand-up career?
There is no turning pro as a comedian. It's just you just get thrown in the deep end. It's not like you can't, like, try out material. It was a talent contest. This place, Nick's Comedy Stop, which still exists, which is crazy because I've been doing it for 24 years, that the place that I stepped on stage first still exists. Nick's Comedy Stop had a contest, Find Boston's Funniest Comedy Student. And it was just basically, you know, a big hype thing to get a bunch of college kids in there drinking, watching their friends go up and bomb. And I saw it and I just immediately called the number before I chickened out, before I really had to think about it. And I do remember vaguely sitting down trying to write material, and you're just sitting there going like, how do you do this? Like, I've always been funny in class, but like funny just happened. You just sort of improv in your whole life. Like, you know, you see something, you make a joke, you make people laugh, you throwing shit in or whatever. But now I'm going to sit down and artificially create this moment. Like, how do I
get to the funny and stuff. And, you know, that took a while. Definitely took a while.
But is that like, I mean, I would imagine it's just like some of the guys, I watch History of the Eagles. Were you a big Eagles fan?
Yeah, I worked in a warehouse, so they played it. It got to the point they played them so much that there was a few groups that I had to take like a decade break from.
Right.
They were one of them. Zeppelin.
Yeah.
The Eagles, Crosby, Stills, and Nash. We had like classic hits on. There was the guys who worked in the warehouse also played in a band, and they played a lot of that classic rock stuff. So they listened to that. WZLX was what it was, and they played that shit from like 9 in the morning till 5 at night, and it got to the point of like, I can't listen to this stuff anymore.
Yeah, I can get you on the decades off stuff because they hit them so hard for so long. I need a little break myself. But and listen to how those guys learned how to start writing songs. It was an interesting process. So here you are. You're coming out of communications. You get on the stage. You're going to write this, your first gig.
I was not communicating.
I know.
when I got on stage, the communication was going well.
So did you win the gig, or how long was your first set?
It was supposed to be 5 minutes, and I think I did like 3, and I bailed. I made fun of the host, and then I just got off. My first time doing stand-up, and I would say this to anybody who's getting into it, like the first, you know, 10, 20 times you do it, has nothing to do with how well, good or bad you're doing. All it has to do with is when they call your name, having the balls to go back up there or go up there the first time. That's all it is. Like, you know, and I just was joking with the buddy Rogan. I was joking with him, just going like, I am so glad YouTube did not exist when I was going through my, am I the next Bill Hicks phase? You know what I mean? Yeah. There is a phase that a lot of comics go through, myself included, where you think, hey, am I going to be the guy with the leather jacket smoking the cigarette, you know, telling them how it is, you know?
Yeah.
It's sort of like, you know, and everybody, whether you had the jacket and the cigarette, you know, kind of tried that hat on for a minute. And thank God, I know they exist somewhere. The footage is on a VHS tape somewhere in the back of one of my closets, but it'll never see the light of day, right?
But when you you hit the stage and all of a sudden you start getting booked, I mean, what's the dues paying process? Are you working another job on the side?
It's a lot like when I read books on, like, you know, I've read all you guys' books. Like, one of my favorite ones was Ric Flair, To Be the Man, You Got to Beat the Man. I own that in hardcover. Like, I read all of those things. And what the stuff that I related to the most was the dishonest promoters and being in a car with another performer and laughing and joking and having beers afterwards. But obviously the level of physical pain and the shit that you guys went through is way beyond. Our stuff is more like just absolute humiliation. Just like, you know, this still sometimes, like, I will think about stuff that happened to me when I was on stage. It always happens when I'm in the shower. I don't know why. And it's just some of the, like, where I just got so owned by a crowd and had no comeback. And just how embarrassed I was. And there's always friends in the crowd when it happened. Every once in a while when those memories come up, I literally have to like shout it out of my brain. Like, I'll just be in the shower and my wife will be down the hall and she just hear me go like, oh. And then she'll be in the kitchen going like, are you okay? I'll be like, oh yeah. So I just, you know, my back.
Yeah.
And it isn't. It's me thinking about like, you know, yeah, I took some bad ones. It's weird. The older I get, they're like starting to fade from my memory. But I mean, there's definitely a lot of horrific gigs, not getting paid, you know. I mean, in the first, you're just so happy that you're getting any stage time. And that's another big thing. At some point, you got to put a worth on what you're doing, because you just come into the business hat in hand, like, I'll do anything. I'll clean the bathrooms. I'll sweep up. Just give me 2 minutes. I'll drive, you know, I was in Massachusetts. I used to drive up to New Hampshire and Maine for 5-minute sets. And I was, you know, I was working with my dad in a dental office, right? And we'd be numbing up people, pulling teeth. And why he would be, I'd just hand him the shit. And then the second the gig, it was over, I'd go out and go do a gig. And I was still living at home, so my dad knew I was going all the way up to Maine. And he would book patients at like 7 in the morning. Like, my dad was just a lunatic how hard he worked, like 7 to 7. And, you know, I would come home. I'd get home at like 3 o'clock in the morning, and I would wake up, and I wouldn't be worth shit. And he'd be like chewing me out in front of the patients. Like, Christ, Bill, you're out to lunch, like right in front of somebody sitting there with their mouth open and shit. But I still remember the first time I got paid $5 in gas money, and it blew my mind. I just remember I had this 83 Ford Ranger, vinyl seats, piece of shit, just like the anti-pussy mobile, right? Just driving this thing. And I just remember just looking at that $5 bill thinking like, I got that for telling jokes. And just that whole idea of like, can you imagine if I could actually like not have a day job? I remember just, it was very, the dream was very incrementally. Imagine if I became a paid comic and I was just the host, and then imagine being the feature, and then imagine being the headliner. And then I remember just fantasizing about the day I could quit my day job. And I started out also with Dane Cook, and I remember he was working at Blockbuster Video, and I remember the day like he quit. He was telling me he was quitting. Like, I vicariously lived through it with him, and I was, yeah. And then, like, I remember like calling him up or seeing him at Nick's like later on a few days later, being like, dude, what's it like? What's it like? He's like, oh, it's awesome. He goes, you wake up whenever you want. You just sit in there. I remember he said this. He goes, like, you know what? I'm going to have some toast. And like that freedom has never, I've never taken that for granted. Like the unbelievable freedom that you have once you're a working comic, where you can just, you know, you work when you want to work, you know. I mean, it doesn't happen. I mean, this, when I got to that level, it took like 20 years to be like, okay, I can now, I have a following, I can yeah. work like that. But I still remember how awesome it was. And when I would do the road, I was a big sports fan. So I just, you know, I would just look at, like, you know, if I had a bunch of college gigs, I would just take out the baseball schedule, football, hockey, whatever the hell it was. And I would just book gigs around there. I would drive out of my way to go see shit. But a lot of that stuff was, unlike you, where it was just me by myself, those college gigs and shit. Went to like the Mall of America.
Yeah, but if you're driving down the road by yourself, are you sitting there thinking, okay, you see a billboard, or you just start thinking about something? Are you trying to think of shit all the time?
You know what I would usually, I was usually listening to music, fantasizing that I knew how to do that. And like, I have this, like, I just constantly daydreaming of me being a hero. All the fuck, I don't know why that is. But like, if I listen to a Stevie Ray Vaughan song, right? Stevie, when he's doing something great, which is usually most of the song. But if I listen to like Stang Swang, then I'm thinking I'm Chris Layton playing the cool drums in the beginning. Right. And it's just so, it was music, sports, and making people laugh. That's like my, you know, triangle offense of like trying to be happy. And so like, only making people laugh was the only thing I was actually good at. Everything else, I was just like, you know, weekend warrior stuff. But music was a huge thing to me. So I was always listening to all the shit I grew up on, like AC/DC and Guns N' Roses. And then when I met Patrice, he got me into like, you know, Biggie Smalls and Ice Cube and all that. And I remember I'd always try to buy rap tapes, and he would just look at them and just throw them out the window. And then and just laugh at me and go, this guy stinks. And then he'd tell me the guy's real. But then he was funny. I would, you know, I tell him about Led Zeppelin and all that type of stuff. He got totally into the Beatles and stuff. It was really funny.
So when you're going out and you're doing your first gigs, I remember when I first started in the business in Dallas, Texas for 2 months, I'd work 2 days a week, Friday night and Saturday morning, and the bad guys would come in and just kick the shit out of me with kendo sticks and weightlifting belts. I was paying my dues, and then they shipped me off to Tennessee, and that's when I started working full-time. And I show up, and I'm going to have my first match in a territory that I don't know anybody. I'm 2 months in the business, and all I've been doing is getting the shit kicked out of me.
Right.
And so
now, what's your job tonight? Are you supposed to win or lose?
I'm a good guy. I'm going to win the match, and I'm a babyface, as we would call it. And Dutch Mantel says, Steve, you're working with what's his name over there? He's wearing a mask. He goes, go out there and give us about 8 minutes, and you'll beat him. I can't remember how I beat him. All of a sudden, he told me 8 minutes. I'm thinking to myself, God damn, what the fuck am I going to do for 8 minutes?
Yeah.
You know, because you're scared of time.
Yeah.
You know, and then as you get, you know, a couple more months, a year or two, dude, you need 20, 30, 40, right? So how did your routine grow from, you know, your first, you know, 5 minute gig, which turned into be 3 minutes at the college thing?
That's so crazy, the similarity of this. Yeah. How'd you get your time up? That's what we call it. How do you get your time up? Was basically, all right, so you had, like, in Boston, it was Nick's Comedy Stop, The Comedy Connection, and Giggles. Those were, like, the A rooms. So that would be, like, working for was WWF when I was a kid.
Yep.
WWE, right? And then you had all these, then you had the B rooms and C rooms. So these would be, like, different wrestling circuits. So it'd be, like, in A rooms, I would be a host. In B rooms, I could feature. And if it was just some absolute shithole, actually, I never headlined, and I think maybe one time I did before I moved to New York. When I moved to New York, I knew I had 45 minutes at that point, but I had never done 45. So I had 45 minutes. I could talk for 45 minutes if I could remember all of it. And I remember I talked to this guy, Roger Paul, And I had already sent him my tape, and he really liked me. And he was the first guy that headlined me. And he goes, did you headline up in Boston? And I just lied. I said, oh, yeah, I can handle that. And what would happen was when you first start headlining, you're used to doing 30 minutes. And what kept happening was I get to 30 and it would go great. And then there was like 7 minutes of what the fuck.
Yeah.
As I'm saving basically my finishing move was my closing bit. Yeah. And I'm saving that thing, right? And so my sets would, if you were to graph them, would gradually build. And then there'd just be this lull. And then I would get out on the closing bit and it'd go back up again, but it wouldn't get to the same height as 30 right. minutes. So it was kind of like, that's what it was.
What are you thinking when you put your set together? Because here's the thing.
I have an idea what I'm going to open with, and I know what I'm going to close with. Like, I kind of know all the jokes, but then, like, I don't have, like, the set order. Like, it goes much better if I just think about the joke and then I just do the joke. And sometimes I have callbacks to jokes, but I haven't told it yet. But what it does is it gets you to be present. Like I am, you know, whatever. I am at the Comedy Store in Los Angeles. I'm at the Punchline in San Francisco. Like I am here right now as opposed to being up there. Like I did the whole write it all out word by word, memorize it, always say it the same way, do it in the same order. I did that and I found myself on stage. It was like when I was reading a book, like my brain would just be going. And then I would start thinking like, I have not thought about this crowd or what the fuck I've been saying for like 3 minutes, which is a long time. And then I would start thinking like, why are they even laughing? Like, what is even funny about this? And then the second I just start bombing. Like, it's like I'm in a plane and it starts losing altitude and I can't figure out why. And so I have to go, you know, I have to switch it up. What I found works for me is my buddy called me recently. He goes, man, he goes, we get the third show. He goes, there's only like 30 people going to show up, 30 reservations. And from all of those years, I got like this jolt that went through me because I did the whole, oh, there's only 30 people up here. So I'm going to go up and, you know, act like there's 30 people. And then one day I was just like, fuck this. I'm going to murder these 30 and make them wish that they brought 30 more, which is not the most original thought, but I can't remember. Somebody told me to do that, but I just started approaching it like sports. Like, it's all right, we're down 18 runs, but you're not going to win by 19, and I'm going to make this fucking miserable for you, right. And I'm going to try to foul off as many pitches, whatever I got to do. And it's like that athlete-like mindset of not losing, like if you apply that to stand-up, you know, you always, like, there's got to be luck, there's got to be the talent, but the biggest thing is you have to have that thing where, you know, you're in the middle of Dallas in some shithole, and everybody else is sitting there going like, oh, do I really want to do this? Should I get married and have kids? And you're out there just fuck this, yeah. Flying across, and you have to kick the shit out of them, or it's going to start dipping, and they're not going to come back.
You got to give them bang for the buck.
You have to.
They bought a ticket. You got to give them everything.
You have to.
This is the Steve Austin Show.
Support for this podcast comes from Pluto TV. Need an escape? Drop into Pluto TV for a world of free TV. Stream hundreds of channels and thousands of movies and shows all for free. Yeah, free. No subscriptions, no fees. Imagine 24/7 channels of Narcos, CSI, Star Trek, Survivor, and everything else from hit movies to binge-worthy TV shows, the latest news, live sports, comedy, and more. What are you waiting for? Download the free Pluto TV app for Android, iPhone, Roku, and Fire TV and start streaming now. Pluto TV. Drop in, watch free.
Going back to one of the points you made a while ago, I think you'll agree with. I'll put the hammer on what you were saying. I was talking with Zach Wilde.
Oh yeah, he's awesome.
You know Zach?
Yeah.
It's a funny thing. Before I started rolling the recorder, Bill walks into my house. He meets my wife and my dogs, and we come in here. And I have a guitar on my wall, as most of you people that listen to my show know about my Stevie Ray Vaughan guitar. And he goes, "Jesus Christ!" He goes, "Is that real?" And he dug the guitar. And so I told Bill, I said, out of 95% of people that come here, nobody ever notices that goddamn guitar. That's one of my prized possessions.
I first saw the Stevie Ray picture, and I was just like...
Found that. We was up in Santa Barbara, and we was going through an old little file thing, and I saw the Stevie Ray black and white and had to have that thing. But Zach Wilde told me, just speaking of guitar players, I asked Zach one time, I was at Ozfest somewhere in San Antonio. Man, I think we were about to get lit up, hammered, and... I told him he was in his in his room just fucking shredding. And I said, "Goddamn, Zach." I said, "What are you thinking when you're doing that? How do you play all that?"
Yeah.
He goes, "Steve." He goes, "Bro," he's from Jersey.
Yeah.
He goes, "Steve, if you're thinking, you're stinking."
Yeah. You just flow into the next idea.
Because same with pro wrestling, dude. I mean, you got to think. Here's the thing, and I want to get your feedback on this, because, dude, okay, just say we're at Chicago Rosemount Horizon, my favorite building. They renamed it. My favorite building to work in because of the acoustics, and the people there are just rabid for wrestling. And so 18,000 strong, you go in there, and when you're having your match, you're listening to the response of that crowd, because each time you go into
yeah.
a spot, if I'm working, okay, say I'm working a heel and you're babyface. I'll be the bad guy, you're the good guy. I'm calling the match. Boom, bing, we're working. Bam, I'm working that crowd. I'm popping them. Bam, I'm going to bring you down, settle them down. I'm going to piss them off by getting some heat on you, fire them up by
That's
giving you
so
a little bit of something.
Cool.
And then, boom, we're gonna make them come on this comeback. And then the finish, that's explosion. So my point is, we're listening to that fucking crowd. I can't hear for shit, but I can hear a crowd. If you've got 18,000 people in there, and 17,999 of them are cheering, and one motherfucker up there in row 100E is booing, I can hear him.
Yeah.
And so I'm tuned in that crowd. So you've got to be, like you said, sometimes those 3 minutes goes by, but you, to me, you read a crowd like a motherfucker.
You do it long enough, you don't...
You're very instinctive.
It's this big thing. It's this big noise. It's a big noise that you're controlling, and then you got to know when to bring them up, when to bring them down. That took me the longest time to learn. I remember one time, one of those times when I was, you know, when I just told that guy, Roger Paul, that I closed rooms. So he put me in some room. I can't even remember where the hell I was at. Put this guy in the middle, just murdered. And I forget what bodily fluid joke he ended on. And they go into the proctologist and he's got his finger up my ass and the fucking place is going nuts.
Yeah.
Like he has him up to 11. So I made the mistake is I went on stage and tried to start at 11 and I had nowhere to go. I got about 10 minutes into my set and I was literally out of breath from telling jokes. And I was like, and then when I was 5, and it's just like, and I just started bombing for like 5 minutes and then I gradually built it back up again. I remember I got off stage and I had a headache and, you know, and I was a baby about it and I called a comic, you know, talked to an older comic. I'm like, this fucking guy is doing all this bodily fluid stuff, you know, he's fucking screaming. It's the fucking, I've seen a million guys do that joke. And he just said, dude, he goes, don't ever do that. He goes, just go up. He goes, keep it going for that guy. Wasn't he great? And just start slow. Start slow and just gradually build it up again. But blah, blah, blah. And I was like, you can do that. He goes, yeah, just do that. And that was like, you know, I mean, so much of the stuff that I learned by completely failing. And then an older comic told me, you know, how to work that out. But I remember the first time where I was conscious that I was being able to read a crowd. But I was working this place, Harvey's, in Portland, Oregon. And the dude who ran it he had like all these telemarketers. You just paper the room. So you do a Tuesday through a Sunday, 3 shows Saturday, 2 shows Friday, you know, like, you know, all inclusive, like a $1,500 thing. So by the end, I think after taxes, you walk with like $300 to do like 9 shows or some shit, right? So I come in there Tuesday night and it's just packed. And I was like, holy shit, like this is like, I thought I was just gonna lean on the mic and fuck around. So once you establish that you're there, I didn't have to be there like an hour before the show. So come Thursday, I came walking in about 10 minutes before I went on, and I walked in and I walked in the room. I was in there for like literally 3 seconds and I looked at the waitress and I said, what happened? And she goes, well, the guy on stage, he kind of told a joke that people thought was, I don't know, kind of sort of sounded racist and blah, 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 blah. Like I just felt the crowd. Like it wasn't like, it wasn't the energy of this guy's bombing. It wasn't an energy of like, you know, we're drunk and we don't care and we're rowdy. It was this energy that something happened. Like, did somebody just get thrown out or whatever? And I remember thinking like, I remember trying to afterwards think about what was that sound. And it isn't a sound. It's just a feeling you get. It's so weird. It becomes back to that Zach thing you were saying, well, if you're thinking, you're stinking. Like, so when I tried to, you know, break down the thought of what it is, you can't verbalize it. So that's the same thing. The same thing. Like, that's so fucking cool. You're listening to it. Building it up and bringing it down.
Yeah, but I'm watching you, Sussie.
That's unreal, man.
But here's a story that goes...
Yeah, but you guys are beating the shit out of each other. I'm just up there going, you know, what's up with Obama? You guys are like...
I'll tell you one time, like when like I miss Ric Flair when he came up because it was back then you had territories. So yes. we were Vince McMahon's WWF.
Yes.
And I forget what he NWA. So I missed all of his stuff, and but you still heard about him.
Oh yeah.
And it wasn't until, you know, like the mid-2000s when, you know, YouTube came out and everybody posted the clips. And I just went down this rabbit hole one night. And I went from just hearing about the legend of Ric Flair to being like, I mean, like he had like so many times, like if I would have bad gigs, I would watch your guys' clips and stuff and guys being on the mic. And his stuff, I mean, it's still my favorite one ever is when he held up that loafer and he told the guy his shoes cost more than his house. I remember when I was trying to describe that line to my wife, I was literally crying laughing, and she was going like, you know, because she's not into the, like, she, you know, I'm just telling it secondhand. She goes, was it really that funny? I was like, Nia, you had to see the guy's face. It was probably true. If you looked at the guy he was saying it to, and this guy was standing there, and what I loved was he was so bought in to the character of Ric Flair. Like, it was so fucking real to him. I loved it.
Oh, dude, and you're hitting it 100% on the head. He was so convicted. It was a shoot. I mean, that in our business, like you said, a shoot match. I mean, that when somebody buys in that deep, he's living it. And it was real to him. Just a parallel to a quick story. I always tell a story all the time, but I'll give it to you because you've been there. Talking about following that guy who had the bodily fluids. He's like, God damn, how do I follow that? It's trying to start out at 11. Dude, we used to go over to Japan, and all of a sudden, you're in the slot, and you're right behind either like a Chris Benoit, Dean Malenko, Eddie Guerrero. I mean, just some of those guys that are cruiserweights that just go like crazy. Nobody's business. Just extreme workers.
Right.
Badasses. And all of a sudden, I got my limited move set. You know, I got a right hand. I can kick somebody, and that's about it, right? I got a headlock. But after these guys went and blow the roof off a place, what do you do? How do you follow that?
What would you do?
You just go do your shit.
Right.
I can't try to emulate what they did. I've never done it in my life. So now all of a sudden, because they went out there, lit the crowd on fire. So you just go out there and you do your shit, and you're convicted like Ric Flair was on the promo with the shoe. You just do your match. You lay your shit in, and your intensity's high, and you don't rush it. And so that's how you follow.
Try it. You must have early on, like, okay, I got to do some moves like that, even though they weren't part of your.
When I was over in Japan, you know, I used to do a top rope splash, and the dude moved. He was supposed to, and I tore my tricep off my arm. We was in Japan for 3 weeks. I tore my tricep off on the third night, so I got to wrestle for 2.5 weeks with the torn tricep. You know, so that's when I knew that. Sticking to the ground was going to be, you know, where I was going to make, you know.
Have a long career.
Yeah, where I was going to have a long career. Answer me this question, because sometimes, dude, we go out there and just say, like you said, sometimes one time a long time ago was me and Flying Brian, we were wrestling Shane Douglas and Ricky the Dragon Steamboat, and it was a big snowstorm.
One of the greatest names ever.
Yeah, and so nobody could get to the building, and there were literally 50 or so people there. And man, we went out there just like a story you said a while ago, and we lit that place on fire. 30 minutes of bust ass tag team wrestling.
That's
awesome.
We
put on a show.
That's awesome.
The Steve Austin Show. The Steve Austin Show.
Hey man, do you own or rent your home? Sure you do. And I bet it can be hard work. You know what's easy? Bundling policies with GEICO. GEICO makes it easy to bundle your homeowner's or renter's insurance along with your auto policy. It's a good thing, too, because you already have so much to do around your home. Go to GEICO.com, get a quote, and see how much you could save. It's GEICO easy. Visit GEICO.com today. That's GEICO.com. But sometimes when you go out there, whether it's 50 or whether it's 20,000, sometimes you go out there and you've been on the road for a long-ass time, and you're a pretty good hand. Maybe say at the 5-year mark, and then I'll go to the 10 or 12-year mark for me. But sometimes you go out there, and you just get a crowd that ain't buying shit. As over as you are, Stone Cold Steve Austin, or as funny as you are at a scientific level, Bill Burr, you ever get a crowd these days that just all of a sudden just kind of lukewarm to the shit you're doing? Or are those days gone by because you're so good at what you do now?
It's more once you get known. Once you get known, then, like,
You're a big guy.
It becomes easier. Yeah, like I'm not as, you know, if I went up against a crowd like that, I haven't done it in a while. Like I can remember the last time that happened to me. I was going to do Letterman, and I needed to get 5 minutes, and I was, you know, I was new out here, so I went to some. This guy had this room out in Glendale, and it was just a bar. It was just a bar, and most people came there to watch the Laker game. And the host goes up, he bombs. The next person goes up, they bomb, and like 2-3 people in a row are just bombing bad. And I was in the back going like, ah, I'm going to get him. They knew the kids, blah, 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 blah. Once I get up there, hey, I bet some people here are going to know who I am. You know, I've got a half hour on Comedy Central. I did a little something on HBO, and I went up there, and nobody knew who I was. And I had to work totally clean and just go through this, hey, what's up with this? You know, late night TV show, dude. And I ate my balls, And then I just abandoned my TV set and I tried to turn it around by giving shit about the Lakers, you know, rather than, you know, going a positive route, which I never go. I should have gone like, hey, man, you guys like the Lakers? All right. You know, just something to get them in.
Yeah.
I was like, fucking Kobe's overrated. How much free agency help do you like? And they were just like, hater. And then they just turned back around. And it was just like they just ignored me. And I'd been in it long enough where I just laugh. Walking. Well, there you go, you egomaniac. That's what you get for that. Yeah. You know, you thought you were going to go up there and everyone was going to be, you know, thrilled to see a guy that was on VH1's I Love the 80s, whatever the stupid talking head show credit I had back then. And but like, you know, I guess, you know, recently I've opened for a few bands, and that can be a difficult thing where they are, when a crowd's standing up and they're there to see music and then you come out, that it's a really, you know, I have major, like, I don't care how long I've been doing stand-up, how big I ever got. There would never be a moment where I wasn't plotting backstage on a gig like that, going like, all right, I need to do this.
Right.
I need to do that. Make sure you don't do this because it didn't work the last time. I got to open for Queens of the Stone Age one time, which was killer, man, because, you know, one of my favorite bands ever. And I just knew it. I knew going out there, I was like, oh, man. So I went out there, and I was having a good set, and it just always gets to that point, you know? Like, they've had enough.
Yeah.
They didn't come here to see you. Came here to see rock stars, not some sickly-looking Ron Howard jackass, right? So I got, like, 12 minutes into this, and this fat chick just started screaming at me and wouldn't shut up. And so I kind of trashed. The lead singer, Josh, said, he goes, nah, it went great. It's funny. He didn't like his set, and I didn't like my set. I ran into him recently. He was like, dude, you were better than us last night. I go, no, I wasn't. I go, I had that fat chick screaming at me. He goes, no, but you handled it perfectly. Yeah. I was like, I just told her to go fuck herself. I didn't do anything. And then I was just like, I sort of got her to shut up, and then I just kind of gracefully tried to get off the stage. But way back in the day, I used to open for like Wynonna Judd, and I did it like maybe 4 or 5 gigs with her. And those things were either great, or they were just like if it was inside, I had a chance. If they were sitting down, but I mean, I think we did Del Mar one time. We did like that outdoor racetrack, and it was like in the middle of the day, comedy during the day, outside, sun's out, and I just come walking out like it was, you know, yeah. So like if there's situations like that, then I still can't get out of those. I mean, there are impossible situations, so you just have to sit. What I do is just mentally, I just start thinking of all the comics I'm going to call the second I get off stage to tell them how bad I ate my balls. Just, and then you can laugh about it, you know?
Yeah, but it always feels to get it off your chest because, I mean, sometimes you go out there and you think you're going to rock the place. I mean, you get them, but you could have done better. And it's always, you're always hanging. And this is going back years for me. You're currently still doing it. I stopped a long time ago. But you just hang on that last performance. I mean,
if
you rocked them, I mean, fuck your own cloud nine. All of a sudden, it's kind of like, you know, when you're wrestling business, it takes you like maybe 5 years to really get it. And then you go from there to the other levels. But at 5 years, you should be pretty proficient. So you think, okay, I got this shit. All of a sudden, you go out there and you just lay a big pile of shit in the ring. Nobody gives a fuck. They didn't get with the match and just go to the back. Everybody knows you stunk the joint out. Goddamn, I thought I knew how to do this shit.
That's the worst.
Sometimes you do, sometimes you don't.
Yeah, you walk backstage and everybody's avoiding eye contact. It's like, oh,
so
man.
The next night you go out there and your confidence level has got just a little bit lower. So you're hoping you get this crowd to get your confidence back. Cause, dude, if you lose your swagger and
it's over,
I mean, you ain't got it no more.
That was me in 99 or 2000. Well, I had failed in L.A., and I moved back
When did you first come to LA?
To New York, like 96.
How did you fail out here?
I just was not booking anything, and I couldn't get stage time. And once you're the new guy and then nothing happens for you, they're kind of over you. And then there's the next wave of new. There's always going to be, you know, the thing about it is when you come out here, if you don't have a voice or anything like that, you're just a piece of meat. And they threw you up. So I was a piece of meat. They threw me up there and, you know, I was like, hey, potential. And after a little while, when nothing's happening, you know, another 3-4 waves of young guys come in, you're out. And that's basically what happened. So I moved back to New York. I had a manager and agent. They dumped me, and I had no manager, no agent. And I just remember when I made the decision to go back to New York, it was just like, all right, why did I get into this business? I wanted to become a good comic. So I can't get the stage time out here. I got to go back to New York. And I remember thinking, I'm going to go back to New York, and I'm going to get so funny, they have to book me. That was the only game plan I had. I went back to that walk-through bedroom. That was when I started living with Bobby Kelly. This is the 90s, you know, rollerblading and all that shit, right? Way back then. And I just did a zillion shows. Just a zillion shows. And then one day, I don't know, come out the other side. And, yeah, you start thinking, oh, how the hell did I get here? It's just like I just put my head down and did a million shows. And Dave Chappelle and Neil Brennan hooked me up with a couple of episodes of Chappelle's Show. And then that thing blew up, and I got to experience, like, you know, from a safe place where it wasn't me. It was right. I was standing near the guy and watched somebody go up like the Beatles, you know. And then it cooled down again for a little while. Did a little half hour for HBO. Opie and Anthony, that was a huge year, 2005. Jim Norton got me on the Opie and Anthony show. So those guys with the HBO special coming out, that gave me a little bit of a bump. So I could sell tickets on the East Coast and for whatever reason in San Francisco. I don't know why, but I think that was more the HBO special. But like all the Opie and Anthony territories, I was doing really well. And those guys used to let me do promos and shit on the on their show. Like they really helped all of us out. And then I guess maybe Breaking Bad and Netflix.
Yeah.
Those were the big ones where you just gradually kept going up and up and up till I'm sitting here talking to you, which is still blowing my mind.
All right, everybody, give me the go home cue. It's time to wrap up his podcast and ride off in the sunset. So let's stop here on that career trajectory note and pick it up next Thursday. Bill Burr hanging out at 316 Gimmick Street, and we'll continue the Unleashed conversation again next Thursday. Hit subscribe at iTunes so you don't miss out. And while you wait for that, why don't you check out Bill Burr's comedy special on Netflix? It's called I'm Sorry You Feel That Way, and you will laugh your ass off. And if you don't have Netflix, just get on YouTube and type in Bill Burr. If you don't think this guy is funny as hell, I'll kiss your ass.
Thank you for joining us for another classic episode of The Steve Austin Show. Please leave a rating and review on Apple Podcasts and tell your friends. For more Steve Austin Show, go to podcastone.com. That's podcastone.com.
Support for this podcast comes from Pluto TV. Need an escape? Drop into Pluto TV for a world of free TV. Stream hundreds of channels and thousands of movies and shows all for free. Yeah, free. No subscriptions, no fees. Imagine 24/7 channels of Narcos, CSI, Star Trek, Survivor, and everything else from hit movies to binge-worthy TV shows, the latest news, live sports, comedy, and more. What are you waiting for? Download the free Pluto TV app for Android, iPhone, Roku, and Fire TV and start streaming now. Pluto TV. Drop in, watch free.
All right, sports fans, Podcast One has two great new shows for you to check out. 7-time NBA champ Robert Horry is bringing big guests and great NBA commentary on the Big Shot Bob Pod.
The Brooklyn Nets remind me of Oklahoma Sooner football, and we got to have to outscore you every time, and that's what the Brooklyn Nets are.
Man, you got Steve Nash at the helm. You got D'Antoni. They ain't thinking about no defense.
And Eric Bolling and Brett Favre come together for Bowling with Favre. Everything from sports to politics to business and culture.
Any insight on what Aaron plans to do in Green Bay?
What I read into his comments were simply frustration. Nothing more than that.
Subscribe now to the Big Shot Bob Pod and Bowling with Favre on the Podcast One app, Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And rate and review the shows on Apple for your chance to be featured.